let's say you were Daniel, and you were giving a message to deliver to your people, and all you've known is captivity. Daniel was a young man, maybe just a teenager, when he was taken off into Babylon, separated most likely from his parents. A man of God who God would use to reveal mysteries, give prophecy. And at the end of your life, Daniel is writing in chapter 12, at the end, it's been 70 plus years, so he's probably 85, he may be in his 90s. He's close to the end of his life, and all you've known is captivity, all you've known is judgment, and you're given one last word, which corresponds with all the other prophecies and revelations that he'd received throughout his ministry. Of course, he's hoping to return from Babylon. He's hoping for the restoration of Israel. He's hoping for national sovereignty to be restored for the people of God. And the last word he gets before his death is that there's not going to be any restoration of Israel. That the captivity, we've already learned, was not just 70 years. It would be 70 weeks of years. It would essentially go on and until the end, when the Messiah would come. And then at the end, we get this last word from Daniel. And the word is, after the end of the 70 weeks of 70 years, 600 years, after the end of all this, there's utter destruction. That the nation's going to be destroyed. That is not a very encouraging word for an old man to receive. Now, imagine the same word coming to us as Americans. If you have the same kind of mindset that I have, we feel like we may be going through a little captivity ourselves. And some of you, maybe like myself, and if you're politically minded, you may be thinking, well, maybe there's hope in 2 years and hope in 4 years from now. And maybe if we do this or that, there's maybe some restoration. Maybe some of the corruption that we see will be revealed. I don't know. I have no word from God on that stuff. But I will say this with certainty. America is doomed. If your hope is in politics, your hope is in the wrong place. I can tell you how America is going to end. Just like Israel ended. If Israel is the theocracy of God, and it ended, what hope does America have? We're not the new Israel. America is not the people of God. America is going to be destroyed one way or another, sooner or later. This is the message of Daniel. And to understand Daniel, I've got to lay out a few theological things to make sense of it. So get your thinking caps on and let's think through Israel as a theocracy, as a nation that was directly underneath God. And you understand the theocracy, national Israel, geopolitical Israel, they were never to have a king. A king was a part of the rebellion of Israel. They wanted a king, and God says they're rejecting me as their king. God was to directly rule over this people, and they were given a geographical place, a land, They were to be the people of God. And that nation, not the people, the people begun 400 years earlier with Abraham, but the nation of Israel was established when they were led out of Egypt and they came to a mountain called Sinai. And God told Moses to gather the Israelites together and come together that they would meet God. God would meet the nation. And he would establish, officially organize these millions of people that come out of Egypt. He would organize them into a nation, a theocracy. The birth of a nation was there at Mount Sinai. And the constitution of that nation was the Mosaic Covenant, or the Old Covenant. And to understand how that nation was arranged, we go back to the covenant God gave with Abraham when we impute that upon the nation of Israel, which is bad theology. It's not correct theology. If we understand the nation of Israel, the nation as a people group, as a theocracy, they were entered into a covenant with God, and that covenant was based upon works. It was conditional. You can go back and read the contract. You can read the constitution of the theocracy of Israel. And God made it very plain to Moses. If you and your people, this group here, obeys my commandments, and he's about to give them the Ten Commandments and the whole law. If you obey my commandments, then I will be your God. And you will be my people. Very clearly. Just think that the nation of Israel is the people of God just automatically and unconditionally is not to understand the Mosaic Covenant. In fact, Paul made it very clear in Deuteronomy chapter 7. Thou shalt therefore keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which I command you this day to do them. Wherefore, it shall come to pass, if you hearken to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God shall keep unto you the covenant and the mercy which he swore unto his fathers, your fathers. That is, if you obey, if you keep my commandments, you do what's right, I'll be your God, you will be my people. Jeremiah says, in chapter 7, verse 23, this thing commanded I them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people. Walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may go well with you. This is why Jeremiah says, hear the words of the covenant, your constitution. Hear the words of this covenant and do them. Now, this contract, this constitution of this nation threatened judgment upon Israel if they did not obey. Deuteronomy chapter 11, 26. Behold, I set before you this day a blessing and a curse. A blessing if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, and a curse if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God. In chapter 8, it says, all the commandments which I commanded you this day, you shall observe to do them that you may live. If you forget the Lord your God and walk after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. As the nations which the Lord destroyed before your face, so shall you perish because you were not obedient unto the voice of the Lord your God. Jeremiah echoes this and he says, hear the words of this covenant, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, cursed is the man which does not obey the words of this covenant, which I commanded your fathers in the day I brought them out of the land of Egypt. Chapter 27 of Deuteronomy, cursed be he who does not conform to all that is written in the law. And this is why Paul says, cursed is every man which continues not in the things which is written in the book of the law to do them. Now this is Israel's constitution. This is their covenant. This is the arrangement that they entered into. And what did the nation of Israel say on that great day at the base of Mount Sinai? They exactly said that. They said to Moses, all that the Lord has commanded, we will do. We agree. They signed the contract. It is official. They've entered into it. The terms are set. But how long did it take for Israel to break the covenant? I mean, you know what it is to sign a contract and, hey, I'm going to pay this every month on the first. I mean, they didn't make their first payment. They broke it there at the base of Mount Sinai. You know, Moses gets the word, all that you said we will do. Moses takes the word back up to God, climbs up the mountain, is going to tell God, hey, they said yes. They're ready to sign. They're agreeing to this. What happens when Moses is delayed up there? They're down there making a golden calf. And Moses is even frustrated with him. So frustrated that Moses comes down and he has tablets of stone that God cut out and written on, and even Moses throws them down and breaks them. God says, move aside to Moses. Get out of the way. I'm going to destroy them all. I'll make a nation out of you. I mean, they broke it from the very beginning. And Moses intercedes on their behalf, and God says to Moses, I will have mercy upon them, not because they deserve it, because I'm going to take their names out of the book of life. But I'll keep them alive for the sake of Abraham, for the sake of the seed, the singular seed, Jesus Christ, by the way. But they're not going to make it. That's why the book of Hebrews in the New Testament says that that first generation that came out of Egypt, that first generation got Joshua, got Moses, got Aaron, Caleb. You got a few, one or two or three. But what does the Bible say about that generation, which was the founding fathers of the nation? It says they all died in the wilderness in unbelief. To be harsh about it, but to be real about it, that first generation is in hell. They're dead. They're in hell. They didn't believe God. They disobeyed God. They broke the covenant. The Lord said to Moses in Deuteronomy 32, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stubborn people. Let me alone that I may destroy them and blot out their names from under heaven. In 1 Samuel 8, it says, the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of this people in all that they say to you, because they were asking for a king. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them, according to all the deeds they have done from the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Amos 2, thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Judah and for four I will not revoke the punishment, because they have rejected the law of the Lord and have not kept his statutes, but their lies have led them astray, those after which their fathers walked. Isaiah chapter 1, hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Children I have reared and brought up, but they have rebelled against me. O sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly, they have forsaken the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. Now, some people say, hey, this is the people of God. No, these are wicked snakes. Though the national people of God, they're a theocracy under God's rule, but these are not believers, at least the majority of them. 2 Kings chapter 17, but the word of the Lord says, for they would not listen. They were stubborn, as their fathers had been, who did not believe in the Lord their God. They despised his statutes and his covenant they made with their fathers, and the warnings that he gave them. They went after false idols and became false. They followed the nations that were around them, concerning whom the Lord commanded them that they should not be like them. And they abandoned all the commandments of the Lord their God and made for themselves metal images of two calves. And they made an Ashtoreth and worshipped all the hosts of heaven and served Baal. And they burned their sons and their daughters as offerings and used divinations and omens and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. Do you know that the Bible depicts the nation of Israel as being worse in the land of Canaan than the original inhabitants of Canaan? I would even dare say that the nation of Israel, I could get in trouble in some places for saying this, the nation of Israel has been the most ungodly, wicked nation has ever faced and lived on this earth. Especially with the light that they had. Especially with the prophets they were given. I hear some people say, you don't have to witness to Israel's. They're already God's people. No, they're not. Jeremiah says, "For I solemnly warned your fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, warning them persistently, even to this day, saying, obey my voice. Yet they did not obey or incline their ear. But everyone walked in his stubbornness of his evil heart. Therefore I brought upon them all the words of this covenant, which I commanded them to do them. But they did not. Again, the Lord said to me, a conspiracy exists among the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They have turned their backs to the iniquities of their forefathers who refused to hear my words. They have gone after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant that I made with their fathers. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I am bringing disaster upon them that they cannot escape. Though they cry to me, I will not listen to them." Ezra 9 says, "Oh my God, I am ashamed and blushed to lift my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads. Our guilt has mounted up to the heavens. From the days of our fathers to this day we have been in great guilt. And for our iniquities we are kings, and our priests have been given into the hand of the kings of the land, to the sword, to the captivity, to plunder, and to utter shame, as it is to this day. And now, O God, what shall we say after this? We have forsaken your commandments." Now, the last book of the Old Testament, there at the end it says, in Malachi, "From the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from my statutes, and you have not kept them." From that first generation all the way to the end of the Old Testament is characterized by disobedience. That's why when Stephen, remember when he was stoned in Acts chapter 7? He was stoned and he gives a summary of the nation of Israel. And he says, "Which of the prophets did you not stone?" From one generation to the next generation, you've been an ungodly people. And now you've killed your own Messiah. Of course, they killed Stephen. What did Jesus say? He says, all the guilt of all the generations is going to be held accountable to this generation. 1600 years from Mount Sinai to the time of Christ, Israel was a rebellious people group, a wicked nation. Now, what must God do to be faithful to His Word? Now, granted, He kept the nation alive. He preserved them for the sake of the seed. Isaiah said, if it wasn't for the seed, again, that's Jesus Christ, the promise that God made to Abraham, we would have been like Sodom and Gomorrah. He would have destroyed us long ago, but He was patient with us because He made us a promise. He made the world a promise. That promise is the gospel. It's Jesus Christ. Now, after Jesus is born, is there any reason to keep that nation afloat? Well, what we learn in Daniel chapter 12, is 600 years prior to the destruction of Israel in 70 AD, God said He's going to do it. What we learn in Daniel, in the whole book, is that the captivity is not just 70 years, it would be 70 weeks of 70 years. And this duration would not end with the restoration of Israel and its national sovereignty restored. We learn that at the end, the Messiah would come, but it would bring an utter end to the theocracy. Covenant would be over. See, God must carry out His end of the deal. In Deuteronomy 28, the Lord will send on you a curse. If you don't obey, He'll send a curse upon you, and it says, until you are utterly destroyed. Hebrews 8:9 talks about this. It says, because they continue not in my covenant, I have regarded them not, said the Lord. And Jesus said to His generation, behold, your house, we'll talk about what that means, your house, in a little bit, is left unto you desolate, completely, utterly cursed. In 1 Thessalonians 2:16, it says, for the wrath of God has come upon, talking about the Jews, to the uttermost, to the fullest extent. Now, what is Daniel chapter 12? Now, I've given you a lot of like context to understand Daniel 12. But Daniel 12 is basically Matthew 24. It's a parallel passage of Matthew 24. Matthew 24 is a difficult New Testament passage. Daniel is basically saying the same thing as Matthew. Jesus is saying in Matthew 24. And what makes Matthew 24, which is one of the most controversial chapters to understand, and we're not preaching on that, but let me give you a little key to understand Matthew 24. And once you see this, it makes Matthew 24 easy, or at least easier. Matthew 24 is, for the most part, talking about 70 AD. But a lot of people get the Great Tribulation out of Matthew 24, but it's not talking about some future tribulation that we have not endured. Matthew 24 is talking about the end of the Jewish world, the end of the nation of Israel. He's talking about what Daniel 12 prophesied, the end of Israel as a nation. And to understand Matthew 24, you have to understand that the disciples asked Jesus two questions. Jesus is up on the mountain looking at the temple, and His disciples come up and they're gazing at the beautiful temple. And Jesus makes His comments. Not one stone is going to be left upon another. See this temple? It's coming down. Daniel prophesied. Daniel 12 prophesied the end of the second temple before the temple was constructed. And disciples asked Jesus, when is this temple going to be destroyed? When? And then they ask a second question. And tell me the signs, what are the signs of your coming? It's two questions. And a lot of people take these two questions and assume that they're one question. And because they're asking, when are you coming back the second time? What are some of the signs? What should we look for to know that you're coming back again? So there's certain things about Matthew 24 that are yet unfulfilled. We're waiting on them because Christ hasn't come back the second time. So you can't take all of Matthew 24 and put it in the past, nor can you take all of Matthew 24 and put it in the future. Some of it has been fulfilled, but some of it has not been fulfilled. And it's quite easy to know which is which, because the disciples turn to Jesus and say, hey, when are you going to do this? When is the temple going to be destroyed? Secondly, when are you coming back? In Matthew 24, tells us, he spends the first half of the chapter, or three-fourths of the chapter, saying, this generation won't pass away. Now, you can't take, your hermeneutics don't allow you to take this generation and put a bunch of generations in between that. That's what you do when the prophecy doesn't come true. You know, you have these conspiracy theories when they say this is going to happen, but it doesn't happen. So you have to make up something to justify why it didn't happen, when it's going to happen. Well, Jesus didn't make a mistake. He says, this generation, my generation, will not pass away until every stone of this temple is brought down. That is a prophecy of the end of national Israel. You've got to understand the temple is their capital building. If that goes down, it's over. You know, when they come back from Babylon, they had to rebuild the temple. The temple was crucial. It was the most prominent of all buildings because their theocracy and their religion are so intertwined, you can't have one without the other. And so if the capital building is destroyed and this religious building is destroyed, if this temple is gone, Israel's gone. Jesus said, hey, it's going to happen within the generation, my generation. This generation won't pass away. And lo and behold, we know that came true in 70 AD. And then at the end of Matthew 24, he says, now concerning the signs of the coming, here are the signs to look for. And then you can read the rest of the chapter, and that's yet to be fulfilled. Well, I say all that because Matthew 24 is basically Daniel chapter 12. And they have a lot of parallels, not only because they're talking about the same date, 70 AD, and the destruction of the temple and the end of the theocracy. You see two things in Daniel 12, Matthew 24, is that you see 70 AD, and then you see glimpses of the end of the world. You see that Daniel 12 refers to the resurrection, which we know has yet to happen. But most of Daniel 12 is dealing with the end of the theocracy. Now, another thing we need to understand when we're... I said, Jeff, when are we going to get to Daniel 12? Well, y'all need some theology to understand this. One of the things to understand Daniel 12, you have to understand that the Old Testament didn't clearly outline two comings. Now, it speaks of the first coming and the second coming, but if you just had the Old Testament and you didn't have the light of the New Testament, you wouldn't easily separate that there could be 2,000 plus years separating the first and the second coming. Well, in the Old Testament, when it spoke about the Messiah coming, it spoke of the things that would happen at this first coming, and it spoke of the things that would happen at the second coming, and it spoke of it as happening it all at one time. And the perfect example of this is seen when John the Baptist began to doubt that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, John heard the voice saying, this is my beloved son. He baptized him and he pronounced Jesus is the Messiah to the world. But at the end of John the Baptist's ministry, a lot of things weren't happening that he was expecting to happen. In fact, John was imprisoned. And now, why would that happen? If the Messiah is here, why am I imprisoned under Roman captivity? I mean, isn't the Lord, the Messiah, supposed to bring liberation from the Rome? And isn't he supposed to bring national sovereignty back to Israel? And how come this is not happening? We're being defeated, not conquering. And so he begins to doubt. And he sends his disciples to Jesus and he says, are you the Messiah or should we look for another? Remember that story? And what did Jesus do? Jesus quotes Isaiah chapter 61. And he says, go tell John the Baptist. What you have seen and heard, the blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have the good news preached to them. Blessed is the one who is not offended by me. Now, he quotes Isaiah 61, a prophecy that no doubt John the Baptist knew by heart. But what's strange about what Jesus said is he stops right in the middle of the sentence and doesn't end it. He basically says the things that at the first coming are being satisfied. I'm healing. The gospel is being preached. People are being saved. But he stops right in the middle of the sentence because the prophecy in Isaiah 61 says, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening up the prisons to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God. So here, and Isaiah speaks of the coming of Christ, and it talks about the day of his favor, that's his first coming, and the day of vengeance, that's his second coming, and it speaks it as one day. And that's the way the Old Testament looked at the coming of Christ as one event. But as William Holcomb says, with characteristic prophetic perspective, the Old Testament prophets intermingled items relating to the first coming of Christ with items relating to Christ's second coming. And it's not until the New Testament times would it be revealed that what was thought of in the Old Testament days as one coming of the Messiah would be fulfilled in two stages, a first and second coming. And this is what we see in Daniel 12. That which take place in his first coming, and a little bit of that which would take place at his second coming. Now, the new covenant, here's another little tidbit you need to understand. The old covenant was established with the theocracy of Israel, and it was based upon a condition. But Jeremiah prophesied the making of a new covenant. You know, you got old covenant, new covenant, Old Testament, New Testament. And Jeremiah says, days are coming, I'm going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, but it's not going to be like the covenant that I made with their forefathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant they broke. But I will make a new covenant, and they shall all know me from the least to the greatest. Now, that's true of the old covenant. You had Joshua, Caleb, Moses, Aaron, King David. You had a remnant within that mix that knew the Lord. I mean, salvifically, personally knew the Lord. But the majority of Old Testament Israel did not know God. And Jeremiah says, I'm going to make a new covenant. Or God tells Jeremiah, I'm going to make a new covenant. And the difference is, they shall all know me. This is the thing about the new covenant. There's not one person in the new covenant that doesn't know Jesus Christ. We all know him, from the least to the greatest. And he also says, and I will forgive their sins and remember them no more. This is the new covenant. It provides grace, forgiveness. The old covenant provided works, law, conditions, and curses. Now, Hebrews 8 picks up Jeremiah about this new covenant, and he talks about the establishing of the new covenant, yet the old covenant had to be abrogated. You know, this one's, that covenant, thank God, is over. Sorry if you, hey, I need that. No, that's okay. But that's what he did to the covenant, the terms. This, and it says that the law, because of the weakness of sinful flesh, could not perfect us. It had to go. The theocracy had to go. It had to be abrogated. It had to be abolished. And that's why Hebrews, when it talks about the new covenant, it says that before the new covenant could be fully established, the old covenant had to go. It had to be abolished. It had to be removed to make room for the new covenant. And it talks about the great shaking, where it would take away all that couldn't stand, so that only that which is immaterial and eternal and lasting would be left in its place. And see, the temple had to go. Jesus is the real temple. He's the real Emmanuel. And when he died, let's say he died right around 35 A.D., 33, 34, 35 A.D., what happened when he died? The temple veil was ripped in half. What does that mean? That's symbolic, right? The way of the holies into the Holy of Holies has been made open. We can go into the presence of God. And when that temple veil, that's officially when that temple had no more meaning. Right? It was gone. However, it took another 35 years. That generation, the generation of Christ, a generation would be 70 years, right? He was born. He was cut off in half of his generation, right around 35. He says, before this generation is over, not one stone will be left upon another. So you see this transition. And even in the early church, they would continue to go to the temple until God dispersed them out from the temple. That temple had to go. The theocracy had to go for the church to rise. Now let's look at Daniel 12 with all that theological content. Let's see if we can make sense of Daniel 12. And we learn eight characteristics of 70 AD. Eight things we'll see about 70 AD, about the end of Israel, the end of the theocracy. First of all, in verse 1, we see that the end of Israel would come with a great tribulation. And I'm not saying there's not going to be future tribulations again. But the tribulation that a lot of people have in Matthew 24, that's 70 AD. And it was prophesied in verse 1. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. Matthew 24 says, so when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the housetop not go down to take what is in his house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back and take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation, such as not have been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And in those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. That's not talking about, in my understanding, of a future tribulation. It's talking about the end of Israel. And that end came with the greatest calamity and tribulation that nation had ever seen. Now, you can imagine if that would be the case, because God, Jesus, told those people, upon you, on your head, upon this generation, all the wrath of all the previous generations would be poured out on. You should expect that the end of the nation would come with great tragedy and calamity and trouble. Philip Schaff, the historian, writes about it. He says, in April A.D. 70, immediately after the Passover, when Jerusalem was filled with strangers, the siege began. The zealots rejected with sneering defiance and repeated proposals of Titus and the prayers of Josephus, who accompanied him as an interpreter and mediator, and they struck down everyone who spoke of surrender. The crucifixion of hundreds of prisoners, as many as 500 a day, only enraged them the more. Even the famine, which began to rage and sweep away thousands daily, enforced women to roast their own children, the cries of mothers and babies, the most pitiable scenes of misery around them, they could not move the crazy fanatics. History records no other instance of such obstinate resistance, such desperate bravery and contempt of death. What he is describing is there were false prophets who were claiming the Messiah was going to come. They rejected and killed the Messiah, by the way, but they're still thinking their Messiah was going to come and rescue them at the last second from the Romans. And these fanatics, these zealots, these Jewish zealots, believe they had God's favor when they under God's wrath, believe that God was to go and rescue them so they would not surrender. They should have surrendered because the whole city was surrounded by the Romans and they cut off their water supply and the food supply. The siege was raging and they were starving to death to the point that mothers had to eat their own children. They surrender. There's no hope. I mean, you have this massive army surrounding you. There's nowhere to go. But they were blinded by this false hope. And anyone who spoke of surrender were killed. But that was prophesied by Jesus. In fact, you know, because of Matthew 24, all the Christians fled. all that was left in Jerusalem in 70 AD was just unbelieving Jews. In 67 AD, 3 years prior, Vespasian, who's one of the greatest generals under the Emperor Nero, had surrounded the city. And he had them defeated 3 years prior. But something happened in 67, if you know your Roman history or world history. The crazy emperor, Nero, who was insane at this time, he killed off everybody that was a threat to him, even his own wife. He murdered everybody. And thus he was paranoid and insane. He burned the whole city of Rome, blamed it on the Christians. But at the end of all this, going insane, he ran off and killed himself. Committed suicide in 67 AD, which led to Vespasian having to leave Jerusalem to secure the throne for himself in Rome. And all these generals came back to Rome and they ended up fighting one another, as what happens when there's a change of power. And Vespasian, after two other generals temporarily ruled the throne and were killed, Vespasian took the throne. And by 70 AD, he had secured peace in Rome and secured his place upon the throne. And he sends his son, Titus, back to Jerusalem. And when Vespasian left for 3 years to secure the throne in Rome, the Christians saw the abomination of desolation spoken about by Daniel, saw that this was the generation that this temple is going to be destroyed. Christians fled and left. Hope when you flee, as Paul said, as Christ says, hope is not in the wintertime, and hope you're not with child. You just need to get out. Get out. And that's what Christians did. They ran. They fled. Titus comes back in 70 AD to finish what would happen. The second thing we learn about this in verse 4, that it would be a time of increase and progress. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. I think most likely this is referring to the fact that Christ came at the time that the Roman roads were constructed. And Rome had brought the world together, not only with their ships and they're able to travel across the world, but in their military roads that they constructed across Europe and Asia. And when you build an infrastructure or highway infrastructure, what you're doing, you're causing knowledge from one part of the world to come to the other part of the world. So you see an increase of wealth, increase of knowledge, increase of progress. I think that's probably most likely what Daniel is prophesying of. And it's kind of amazing that he talks about this as happening in a three and a half year period. Look at verse 5. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, and two others stood, one on this bank of the stream and one on that bank of the stream. And someone said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. He raised his right hand and his left hand towards the heaven and swore by him who lives forever. And it would be for a time, times, and a half a time. Now, basically, that's a fun way to say 3.5 years. Times is one cycle, or it could be 3.5 months. It talks about times is one, times in the plural is two, and a half a time is a half. So you have a 3.5 period. Now, this could be symbolic, and I wouldn't argue with those who want to say this is just a 3.5 year period of symbolic. But I think it goes quite well with the fact that it took about 3.5 years to conquer Jerusalem from 67 to August of 70 AD. And we see in verse 7, at the last half of verse 7 all the way to 9, that this end would be irreversible. When the shattering of the power of his holy people comes to an end, all these things will be finished. I think this is a prophecy. He said this is not just going to be a setback on Israel. This is going to be the end of Israel. is going to completely shadow them. It goes back to what we've already said in Hebrews 8, 9. Because they continue not in my covenant, God has regarded them not. Philip Schaff talks about this utter destruction that came in 70 AD. He says, when the flames threatened to reach the Holy of Holies, Titus forced his way through the flame and smoke and over the dead and dying to arrest the fire. But the destruction was determined by a higher decree. His own soldiers, roused by madness, by the stubborn resistance and the greedy and greed of the golden treasures, could not be restrained from the work of destruction. At first, the halls around the temple were set on fire. Then a firebrand was hurled through the golden gate. When the flames arose, the Jews raised a hideous yell and tried to put out the fire, while others, clinging with a last convulsive grasp of their messianic hopes, resisted in the declaration of a false prophet that God, in the midst of the fire of the temple, would give a signal for the deliverance of his people. The legions struggled with each other in feeding the flames, and made the unhappy people feel the full force of their unchained rage. Soon the whole structure was in blaze and illuminated the skies. It burned on the 10th of August, A.D. 70, the same day of the year in which, according to tradition, the first temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. No one, says Josephus, conceive of a louder, more terrible shriek than arose from all sides during the burning of the temple. The shout of victory and the jubilee of the legion sounded through the whole welling of the people, now surrounded with fire and sword upon the mountain and throughout the city. The hill on which the temple stood was setting, seething hot, and was enclosed to its base in one sheet of flame. Listen to this. The blood was larger in quantity than the fire, and those that were slain were more in number than those who slew them. The ground was nowhere visible. All was covered with corpse. Over these heaps, the soldiers pursued the fugitives. This is why Jesus, when he prophesied of this event, he looks to the leaders of Israel and he says, your house. Remember, he said, I will build a house. He told David, I'll build you a house. He told Abraham, I'll give you a seed. I'll give you descendants. This house speaks of the descendants of Abraham. It speaks of their racial genealogy. He says, your house. Don't claim to be the children of Abraham. I can raise up these stones to be the children of Abraham. Your house is left unto you cursed, desolate. And one of the things you may not realize, but in the times of Christ, you know, Jesus could, he could, and he was just the son of Mary and Joseph. They were just regular people. But they could trace their genealogies and their family history all the way back to Abraham. But that wasn't unusual, because every Jew in the times of Christ could do that. They had the records. And did you know what house, the archives where it was housed, that had all the genealogies that could trace the Jews back to Abraham? It was housed in the temple complex. And when the flames burned down the temple, what did it do? It took all the genealogies with it. Now you say, well, that's no big deal. It was a huge deal to the house of Israel. What happened when Nehemiah and Ezra, they came back and started to rebuild Israel after the Babylonian captivity? You know what happened? You had the Samaritans already living there. And what are the Samaritans? They're the Jewish people that were left in the city, or left in Israel and Judah. When they went off into captivity, they married the other native inhabitants. And they were a mixed breed of people, half Jew, half Gentile. And when Israel came back, the Samaritans wanted to help Israel rebuild the temple. And what did Ezra say to these Samaritans? No, that's our job. But the Samaritans wanted to build the temple. And when they didn't, they went and built their own temple in Mount Gerizim. At the end of Ezra, in Ezra chapter 10, what does it end with? That some of the Jews that came out of captivity married some of the Samaritans. And now they had to get divorced. And they had to kick out, even their children had to be sent away. Why? Why? Because you didn't have Jewish descent. You can't establish this nation without true Jews, biological children of Abraham. In 70 AD, it erases all that. That is a final blow to the nation of Israel. And I know you may not want to hear this. Some of you may not want to hear this. Oh, there are Jewish people today. Don't hear me not say that. But none of them can meet the requirements that the Jewish people had to meet to live in the land of Israel in Ezra's day. None of them. You know, to live in the nation of Israel now, you just need to have 1/10 of a percent of Jewish blood in you. God truly brought His wrath down upon the nation. He decimated Israel. You see, in verse 8 through 10, it talks about the end of Israel would be a great separation. Look at verse 9. And I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, "Oh, my Lord, what shall be the outcome of these things?" He said, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are shut up and sealed unto the time of the end." This is certain. It's going to happen. And look at verse 10. "Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined. But the wicked shall act wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand." He's basically, for 600 more years until this is done, there's going to be some Jewish people like you who understand, who purify themselves, and the rest are going to continue to act wickedly until the end. Six, the end of Israel will be an abomination of desolation. It says in verse 11, "And from the time that the regular burnt offerings is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be a 1,290 days, which is 3.5 years. Philip Schaff says, "The Romans planted their eagles on the shapeless ruins over against the eastern gate, offered their sacrifices to them, and proclaimed Titus with the greatest acclamation of joy, thus fulfilled the prophecy concerning the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place. Even the heathen Titus reported to have publicly declared that God, by special providence, aided the Romans and drove the Jews from the impregnable strongholds." This is Josephus, who was a contemporary. He eyewitness. He was there. He was a Jewish historian who writes about the history of the fall of Israel in 70 AD. He says, "I will not hesitate to say what grieves me and brings me pain. I believe that had the Romans delayed their punishment of these villains, the city would have been swallowed up by the earth and overwhelmed with a flood, or like Sodom, consumed with fire from heaven. For that generation which was in it was far more ungodly than the men on whom these punishments had in former times fallen. By their madness, the whole nation came to ruin." Josephus claims that 1.1 million Jews were slain. 11,000 perished from starvation, and 97,000 were carried away into captivity. But look at verse 12. The end of the national Israel would come not with just the end of the theocracy, but there would be a remnant of Jews. "Blessed is he who waits and arrives to 1335 days, that is, about 2.5 months after 2.5 years. Blessed is the person who makes it, which gives us the hope that though the nation, the theocracy come to end, that there would still be hope for the Jew. And that's why Romans 11 speaks of salvation still for the Jews. I don't foresee, I don't prophesy, I don't believe in a future theocracy of Israel. But I still believe that there is salvation for us Gentiles, and there's still salvation and hope for the Jew. But it's not through a theocracy being reestablished. It's through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, let's bring this to a conclusion. I know I'm preaching long. What a dreadful conclusion to the book of Daniel. I mean, Daniel just wanted to get past the 70 years, and his last words he gets from God is, it's going to go on 600 more years, and then at that, it's utter destruction. But there is a glimmer of hope. Look at verse 13. But go your way till the end. You shall rest. That means you're going to die. But look at this. And shall stand in your allotted place at the end of the days. You shall rest. You're going to die. You're not going to be here when this happens. But you shall stand. Remember what Job said? Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. That they were engraved in a rock with an iron pen and lead forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and though he shall stand on the last on the earth, and after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh I shall see God. God is basically telling Daniel, your people, this nation is going to come to a climactic destruction end. You're going to rest. You're not going to be there, but you're going to be resurrected. You shall stand, and you shall receive your allotted place. See, this is the blessed hope, and this is the hope that we have. And we're coming back where I started. Our nation is going to be destroyed. Every nation is going to be destroyed. There's no hope in this world. This world is not our home, and we shouldn't place our hope in some type of revival of this nation. Or granted, if Texas went out, I might move down to Texas. But our hope is not in that. Because you know what would happen if that happened? Eventually Texas would go. There's not a nation that you can run to that's not under the wrath of God. There's not a place in this world that you can flee to escape the destruction that's coming. But look at, I skipped this on purpose, but just as it was prophesied that Daniel would be resurrected on the last day, look at verse 1 through 4. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And on those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. See, this is depicting not just the end of Israel, but the end of the world. And at the end of the world, Christ is coming back, and there's going to be a general resurrection of the dead. And there's going to be some who will be raised into contempt. They're going to be separated from God forever and thrown into the lake of fire. But there are going to be some whose names are in the book of life. There's going to be some, those who understand, and those who have led many to righteousness, those who follow the Lord. I can promise you, if we're not here on the day that the Lord comes back, we will see that great day. And though we may watch and we may see the destruction of our nation and we may see the fall of the country that we love, though we may see it, I promise you this, that we will rise victorious. Our hope is not in the salvation of Israel or America. Our hope is in the coming of Jesus Christ when we'll be resurrected from the grave. And if you don't know the Lord, that is the very thing that you must prepare yourself for. For He is coming back. Dear Lord, we close Daniel with great gratitude. Even though it's a hard book, a difficult book, full of judgment, we're grateful that it spoke about the Messiah, and it spoke about the resurrection. And it's these that we hope for in our day. This we pray in your Son's name. Amen.